Hi, everyone, and welcome back. After a brief break, we're resuming our regular schedule, wrapping up season two and heading into season three of PR Future. In the second half of this season, we've talked a lot about polarization, chatting with media professionals, activists, and authors about how we can bridge the partisan gap in these divided states of America. Today, we're going to dive deep in some of the RAND Corporation's research on a related topic with senior political scientist Jennifer Kavanaugh. Jennifer is the co-author of a study called Truth Decay, an initial exploration of the diminishing role of facts and analysis in American public life, which was released by the RAND Corporation in 2018. In their quest to figure out why people have been moving away from facts in their daily lives, Jennifer and her co-author, RAND CEO Michael Rich, came up with a phrase to describe this phenomenon. They call it truth decay. In a nutshell, truth decay describes four different trends around facts and opinion, contributing to the shift away from data. But Jennifer can explain it a lot better than I can.
The four trends that we describe as characterizing truth decay are, first, increasing disagreement about facts and data. An example would be disagreement about the safety of vaccines. These are issues where we have increasing amounts of data that provide us a clear picture of an issue. So in this case, that vaccines are safe and low risk, and yet an increasing number of people believe that that information is incorrect, so believe the opposite. So it's a divergence between data and people's opinions. Second, a blurring of the line between fact and opinion. And alongside that, the third trend, an increasing relative volume of opinion compared to fact. As we've gotten more and more information in our information environment, that information has not increased in terms of opinion and fact at the same rate. So we have way more opinion now than we used to. Because we do have so much opinion, so much commentary, so much analysis, this can overwhelm facts. As a result, opinion and commentary often have more influence. They also can be more emotionally resonant and so attract more attention. Finally, declining trust in key institutions that we used to look to as sources of factual information. So places like the government and the media. And so what we end up with is a situation in which not only do people not know what is a fact and what's not, but they're not even really sure where to turn to find good sources of factual information.
So how can we combat truth decay? As you probably guessed, there isn't one easy answer. But as Jennifer tells us, as communications professionals, there's a lot we can do to help. Stay tuned to hear her thoughts on how we can start to build a future where disinformation is obsolete. I'm your host, Fred Cook, and this is PR Future. You have looked at this over a long period of time, concluded that it's not something new, but is truth decay worse now than it's ever been before?
Whether you look at the period of yellow journalism in the 1880s and 1890s, or the 1920s and 1930s when you have the rise of radio, or the 60s and 70s when you have the emergence and spread of television. In each of these periods, we do see this shift in information technology that seems to play a role in changing how people consume and share information. But what we do see that's unique in this period, if we think about this as the period of the rise of the internet, is this divergence between people's attitudes and beliefs and the data that we have. We don't see that same kind of divergence in these other periods. Vaccines is a good example. There have been vaccine skeptics around since there have been vaccines, so it's not that the skepticism itself is new, but the divergence in people's attitudes from the data. As we get more data, more people are skeptical. So that divergence, that willingness to reject data even when it's presented to you, is something that we see at a larger scale and more prevalent now. We don't really find evidence of that specific trend in these previous periods. You know, there's a couple of reasons why that might be. One is just the nature of the change. The change in terms of the scale and scope of the change in our information environment with the rise of the internet has been obviously much more dramatic than the emergence of television or radio. To find a change in information technology that is similar, you really have to go back to like the invention of the printing press. And so when we think about that scale and scope, that could be driving this difference. Another is just the nature of the internet. If we go online, we can find almost any piece of information, someone who agrees with us, no matter what we believe. So that then allows people to feel like experts, to feel right, to feel justified in sticking to their own opinion, even when presented with false information or misleading information. So this would be kind of like the WebMD effect, right? It's easy to go online and look at WebMD and feel like you're qualified to diagnose yourself, but really you still need to go see a doctor because that's where the expertise lies. And then we also see obviously the role of polarization in creating and feeding these alternative narratives and giving them life and strength that they might not have otherwise. So that's something that we do think is unique about this period.
And we do a lot of research at USC about polarization. It's a topic that we're very interested in measuring and analyzing and helping perhaps reduce. What is the interplay between disinformation, between truth decay and polarization? Are they opposite sides of the coin, or does one cause the other? Or how do you see those two forces interacting?
So in our framework, we describe polarization as a driver of truth decay. We can see polarization existing in places without truth decay. But when we see truth decay, when we see the prevalence of disinformation, it does seem to rely on this polarization for its continuing strengths and power. So the way we think about it is that the polarization, and it's not just political polarization, it's social and demographic and economic polarization, creates insular communities because a lot of these divides are reinforcing. We end up living in communities with people who are very much like us on all dimensions. And that can really foster these insular ideas and an unwillingness to seek out or accept information that's coming from the outside. And that then gives the phenomena of disinformation, which spreads so quickly now on the internet, it gives it additional power and makes it harder phenomena to counter.
And when you look at this problem on a global scale, do you see any other countries that are as polarized or have this disinformation issue as much as the US?
Every country is unique. So some of the ways the United States is unique is, number one, our two-party system predisposes us to end up with this kind of really sharp divide between the two sides. If you look at the European context, they also have disinformation. Polarization plays a role, but it's a much weaker driver because they have just a very different political context. The multiple parties means that things are more likely to be cross-cutting. It means that there's more gray space. So I think that the US political context does predispose us towards this type of phenomena and does give disinformation additional fuel. There is something to this individualist nature of the US social context that I think feeds into this as well and makes it unique.
Well, it's almost become today as though there are different versions of the truth, and people tailor those versions to meet their own needs based on their echo chamber, their background. How do you describe truth in a context like that?
We call this phenomenon truth decay, but what we're really talking about is like facts and evidence. So we don't get so much into the philosophical debates about truth. But what I will say is that I do agree that people are definitely willing to pick and choose their facts to fit the narrative that they want to tell. And I think that that's natural for human beings, just the way that we are predisposed to process information. We tend to cling to things that resonate emotionally with us, that we hear from our friends and family, things that we hear more often, things that we heard more recently, and things that make us feel good, which often means feeling right. And so because of those cognitive drivers, we're kind of predisposed to behave in this way where we seek out those pieces, those facts that allow us to tell the narrative that we want. And so we end up with multiple narratives around any given issue because different people are clinging to different pieces of the full body of facts and evidence that we have.
We had a guest recently on our podcast, Amanda Ripley, who's a journalist and wrote a book called High Conflict. And she said, as a journalist, she always believed her whole career that the facts were the most important thing. But after she investigated polarization and disinformation, she changed her mind. She said they're still important, but they're not the most important thing. Would you agree with that?
Well, I would agree that facts disembodied just by themselves are not very powerful or persuasive. They can be kind of dry and boring. They don't have that emotional resonance. They can be inaccessible depending on how they're presented, if we're thinking about like scientific or technical findings. So I think that when we think about communicating factual information, we have to be able to do it in a narrative context. It is about storytelling. Everything is about storytelling. But there's a difference between a narrative storytelling approach to providing factual information and a narrative approach that's based purely on subjective information. So it's really about the raw materials that we put into the stories and articles and papers that we write.
And storytellers are often in the media. and you referenced this before, how much has the media, whether it's traditional media, cable news, or social media, contributed to this decay of the truth?
Well, certainly the media plays a role. I think it's easy to reduce this problem to a social media problem or just a media problem or an information problem. I do think that truth decay is a much more holistic and systemic problem that stems not just from information, but from the environment in which that information lives. So the polarization, the cognitive biases. If you think about disinformation on its own as being sort of like a match that you drop into a bucket of water, the match will go out. But if you drop a match into a bucket of gasoline, it will blow up. So right now, our social and political context is like that. It's like that bucket of gasoline. You know, that's why we have such a combustible environment right now, is because both the disinformation and because of the social and political context. So that's sort of a warning against overly simplifying the problem. However, I do think that social media and the media both play a role here. I mean, social media plays a role for a whole range of reasons, including especially the speed and ease with which you can spread information to really large audiences. Before, my ability to spread disinformation was limited mostly to who I could talk to that day. But now, if I have a big enough platform, I can spread information to millions of people with the push of a button. So it just really elevates and amplifies disinformation. It also then removes things that we're used to relying on, filters and signals of high quality versus low quality information. The diversity of different voices is both a good thing, but also a challenge. As the information environment has become more diversified, there's been increasing amounts of competition, profit margins are shrinking, and so there's incentives to push for content that attracts the most eyeballs at the cheapest cost. And that's rarely fact-based investigative journalism. It's typically commentary and opinion pieces, because the cost is much lower and they can be more inflammatory. And so there's an incentive here that pushes us towards these opinion type pieces. Now, there's nothing wrong with opinion based pieces. They play an important part in our understanding of issues, but they shouldn't be expanding at the cost of or at the expense of the investigative style journalism, which really helps us to provide the facts and foundation on which opinions can be formed.
You know, it's interesting that you say that. I read a story this week about News Nation, which is a channel that's been started by WGN to be totally neutral news in this environment. And they're struggling to find an audience, even though they're not biased at all. And I thought that was an interesting, a telling commentary on this whole thing.
It's also interesting because when you do surveys and you ask people what they want from news, they say they want accurate and objective and balanced news, but then when you look at what they actually consume, It doesn't really match what they say they want. So I think that that's a really interesting dichotomy that presents a real challenge in terms of how we tackle the problem.
Jennifer, we all recognize that there's a lot of disinformation out there, but what are the consequences of that? Why should people care about that in terms of their daily lives or the issues that are important to them?
Disinformation presents a real threat in a lot of contexts and at a lot of levels. For policymakers, if they don't have good data on which to base their decisions, to develop policies, to debate priorities, it's unlikely that they're going to come up with the types of policies or the decisions that we ultimately need to move forward on tough issues like immigration, healthcare, the pandemic. So having good fact-based and accurate information is essential for good policymaking. So disinformation that exists that affects decisions at that level has trickle-down implications for, you know, the entire country. So that's kind of the high level. At the individual level, disinformation can have real impacts on our own lives as well. If we don't have accurate information, it's difficult to make decisions about how we allocate our own money, how we invest money, decisions about how to protect our own health, especially over the past year. We've seen the consequences that come from false information. If you don't have good information about what to do to protect yourself from COVID, what is high risk versus low risk activities, how to get the vaccine, those things put you at a significant disadvantage.
But let's talk for just a second about the people that do receive this information. Has your research shown that there's any generational differences in how people analyze information to determine whether it's accurate or not accurate?
Well, I mean, we haven't really gotten into the like cognitive science to see if the way people process information is different, although I'm sure there are people doing that work. I do think that this is a phenomenon that affects all ages it probably affects all ages in different ways and on different issues and to different extents. But I would be hesitant to say that it's a problem that affects only one generation and not others.
And given that it's impacting everybody, do you think that this problem is going to get worse before it gets better?
It's a little bit hard to predict what direction it's going to take over the next few years. I mean, certainly we've seen it get worse over the past, say, 5 to 10 years. I had hoped when COVID started that maybe having this really clear example of the way in which facts and science and data matter in terms of helping us to navigate trade-offs, to make decisions, and to ultimately get out of the pandemic would help to shift people's attitudes. That definitely has not happened. Instead, we seem to see, around the vaccine, certainly an even increase in vaccine hesitancy, not just about the COVID vaccine, but spilling into hesitancy and skepticism about vaccines more generally. So certainly that hasn't happened. I mean, I do think that there's definitely room for the problem to get worse. I do see some signs of optimism in terms of greater attention to the issue, more focus on how we can build really strong media literacy curricula, and some hope in terms of actually seeing the ways in which effective media literacy can help to inoculate people to disinformation or at least make them aware of it. So I do see some positive trends that make me hopeful that it won't get worse, but I do think that it's going to take a long time before it gets measurably better. It took us a couple decades to really get to this point that we're at now. And so it's going to take us a significant amount of time and some investment before we actually start to feel like the environment is healthier and better.
And you talk about media literacy, which is an important part of this. I wondered what you suspect or predict academia's role in helping solve this problem should be.
I do think that is a really important and powerful solution, not just for students, but also for adults. We have ways to reach students and young people through their schools. We don't have a good way yet to reach the adult population. So I think that's important. In terms of academia, I think there's a couple of things. If we had more data, we could make decisions about how to structure media literacy to make sure that it maximizes the benefit and has long-term effects. So that's one thing that academia can do, is to specifically engage in this research to help build out that body of evaluative work. And the other thing I think academics can do is to be really conscious and careful about their own research, making sure that they're being honest in how they use data, double checking things. Once false information gets out there or misleading information gets out there, it's hard to put it back in the box. We saw that with the Wakefield autism study. Even though it's been retracted and proven wrong, people still point to it as the reason why they're afraid to vaccinate their children. So being really careful and conscientious about that. And then also thinking, going back to this idea of storytelling, about how we present our research findings to different audiences. At RAND, we're really good at the 300-page report. We're less good at communicating to a general public audience that may not want to spend all their time reading the 300-page report. So how do we communicate these technical research findings in an accessible way?
Well, one thing it looked like in our research that younger people are not reading newspapers, they're not watching much television, they're pretty much getting all their information on their phone. And to some degree, that makes it more difficult to determine the source of it and the credibility of it, because it's all coming in real time. Do you see that technology is a contributing factor to truth decay?
Well, certainly different modes of consumption have different implications. Reading on your phone, it can sometimes, at least for me, and reading on my computer, I feel like I don't read as carefully sometimes. It's easier for things to just kind of flow by me. I think for young people, though, it's a little bit different. Reading newspapers was never something that was really an activity they participated in. They grew up reading everything on their phones and reading everything online. So I think it's likely that some of those differences, or some of the differences I feel in terms of reading things in print versus reading them online, may not be such a big issue. I do think there are some advantages to the online space. It means you can read more stuff. You have the opportunity, if you choose to take advantage of it, to dabble in multiple different types of media, to read multiple perspectives. You're not just reading one newspaper. You can read from multiple newspapers and get multiple views. So I think that there's the opportunity to actually have a much more robust view of news consumption. But we also know that the online space is filled with sort of fluff pieces and things that are only partially true, or things that have some facts but are intended to be argumentative or to focus on advocacy. So when you are reading online, there's more opportunity for good information, for you to consume good information. there's also lots more opportunity for you to be flooded with low quality information. So I think that, you know, again, it's about choices and it's about intentionality in the space.
This is a very complicated problem. And it, as you said, it impacts every major issue that society is dealing with and impacts people's own lives. How do you solve it? Besides media literacy, do you see a solution in the future for disinformation?
Well, I definitely don't see one solution, but I think that there's many pieces of a solution that we can put together. So we've already talked about media literacy. Another possible solution on the demand side is actually just individual initiative, taking the time to seek out multiple sources, to think critically, to not just believe everything you read, to read more than just the headline. These are choices that everyone can make to be better informed. And if everybody went into every day making those types of choices, disinformation would be probably less of a problem because it might be out there, but we'd all be better and more conscientious about identifying it and screening it out. I know that one of the things I learned in working on this project was that I was basically only reading things that provided me ideas that I agreed with. And so I became much more conscious of trying to challenge myself to read things that I knew I would disagree with, but that I might learn something along the way. And then on the supply side, I think that there is room for print, broadcast, and other types of media to do a better job of providing readers and listeners, viewers, with cues about what is a fact and what's not, and try to help them along by really disentangling those types of information and being really explicit about what's being provided. Also, probably some disentangling of, say, like, op-ed or editorial content and fact-based content, both on web pages and newspapers, things like that. A second piece has to do with what we were discussing in terms of academia, communicating and thinking about how we communicate technical research findings. And that means both figuring out how we weave facts and data into stories, but also leveraging strategic messengers, people who exist in communities already that we can use to carry those messages forward. A really good example of that here in Washington, D.C. is they're using this Faith in Vaccines initiative where they're actually giving vaccines at churches. And so they're using the church institution, which is very trusted in a lot of communities, using that to get vaccines into communities where vaccine hesitancy is high. So that's an example of using a strategic messenger to carry that fact-based message forward. My last point is just thinking about the online space. Right now, when we think about governance of online spaces, the debate typically falls into one of two camps. Either we do nothing or we have a ministry of truth. And really there's a whole gray space in the middle there that deals with how we develop institutions that help set rules of the road. We have those rules of the road for newspapers. We have it for television. We have it for radio. We have nothing for the online space. Yeah. And so it does not mean I'm suggesting that we need a government regulation, but we do need to think about how we want to manage this online space and what institutions we need to do that to limit the spread and influence of disinformation.
The PR people in our most recent survey agreed that they thought there would be more online regulation in the future, given all of the problems that have been created for disinformation. Let me ask you about big business. Is there a role for American corporations to play in sort of reducing truth decay?
I do think so. You know, I think corporations have a pretty big platform and a significant amount of influence, and they can use that in a number of ways. One is to, you know, explicitly send messages in support of facts and data and get involved in sort of a public service announcement type campaign. If they don't want to do that, then they can always vote with their dollars and refuse to advertise in places where disinformation is rampant. And so those are two ways that corporations could help to at least contribute to a solution. A third would be just being really conscientious about their own advertising and making sure that to the extent possible, they are being accurate and not misleading in the way they use their own data and their own messaging.
It's a great summary, Jennifer. And I think it just shows that the scope of the problem and the scope of the solution is going to have to be multifaceted. And there's a lot of things that individuals can do for themselves and organizations can do. And let's hope that they all take that action together. The last question I want to ask you, which I ask everyone, is, as you look into the future personally, which emoji would you use to describe your point of view about things?
I think the upside down smiling face. I always try to find the humor in things and always try to have a positive outlook. And even when things seem really bleak, I try to maintain a sense of humor. And I think that people who know me would agree that I am effective and do typically have a good sense of humor, even in rather dark moments. But it's upside down because life seems kind of upside down right now. And so that, I think, summarizes my outlook pretty well right now.
It does seem very upside down. And I'm hoping that the work that you're doing will help right-size it in the coming months and years. And thank you very much for being part of this conversation. It's a very important one. And you're playing a very important role with RAND in bringing all this to light and helping people figure out ways that they can get to the truth and get along better and communicate better. It's important to all of us. So thank you very much for being with us today. And good luck with all your future projects.
Polarization, disinformation, and fake news are complex issues which will likely take decades to unravel. But with increased media literacy, clear news source labeling, and changes in how we navigate the online space, hopefully, like Superman, we can fight for truth, justice, and the American way. And thanks for tuning in to PR Future, a progressive podcast created by PR professionals for PR professionals. You can subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Today's episode was recorded and produced remotely in Los Angeles by Ron Antoinette and Zazu Lippert, with production support from Anthony Baca, Michael Bronstein, and Sarah Latman. I'm your host, Fred Cook, and this is PR Future.